Just because no one had ever recovered from the affliction didn't mean he couldn't be the first. Jane lowered her eyes to the book in her hands. Famous Steeds of England in the 14th Century. "You looked like you needed a book," she said. "It was on top of the pile."
"Thank you."
But the words were automatic, and Jane spent most of the ride staring out the window as a knot of worry tightened in her stomach. It was late when they arrived in the outskirts of London, so a certain stillness of sleeping was to be expected. But tonight, either because of her mysterious summons or because there was truly something off about the city, there was a subtle, almost paralysis in the streets, as if everything were a painting. Even the wind had died. Their carriage clattered unnaturally loudly down the road. A few people appeared in doorways, staring. The Tower of London, too, held that stillness when they arrived, that feeling of a held breath.
"We'd like to take this opportunity to point out that in spite of the name, the Tower of London is actually a castle with many towers. The White Tower, Bloody Tower, the Flint Tower. It's all very impressive."
There were few reasons that might explain why Jane was being taken to the tower in the middle of the night, and none of them were good.
"This is all so ominous," G muttered as the carriage jerked to a halt while the first portcullis was raised. One of the horses whinnied and tossed its head.
"My friend up there agrees." They started moving again, now crossing the bridge over the moat. There was a foul odour rising from that cesspool, but Jane hardly cared and didn't even bother to cover her nose or tell Gifford the impressive, if disgusting, history of the Tower of London moat. When the second portcullis was raised, they moved through the outer ward under another portcullis. There were a lot of portcullises, Jane observed somewhere in the back of her mind, and then made their way toward the majestic White Tower. The carriage stopped right before the door to the keep. Jane glanced across the tower green toward the chapel. Torches burned on walls, but there was no movement save the rustling of raven wings above.
"Please just tell me what this is about," she said.
But her guard only took her book and left it on the seat. She was ushered into a great hall where a crowd of council members waited, and though everyone turned to look at her when she entered, flanked by her husband and a troop of guards, hardly anyone spoke. Jane looked to the throne for Edward, but her cousin wasn't there.
"What is all this?" she asked again. "Why was I brought here? Where is Edward?"
Lord Dudley strode forward, his nose an arrow that pointed straight at her.
"Lady Jane, I'm relieved you could return so quickly."
It wasn't as if she'd been given a choice.
"There is news."
"Obviously." Jane glanced at G, whose face had grown impassive at his father's appearance.
"Please," Jane said at last, "tell me."
Lord Dudley's voice was sombre, but it sounded across the throne room like a gong.
"King Edward VI is dead. Long live Queen Jane!"
12. Gifford. The words "Queen Jane" rang in G's ears, but the more pressing matter was the sudden and extreme paleness of his wife's face. He felt that familiar urge to protect her, the one that had manifested during the pack attack.
"Edward is dead?"
Jane said, her voice almost inaudible.
"Oh, right," G thought. The king's death should have been the most pressing issue. It was only Jane's close relationship to the king that stopped him from saying, "Yes, my lady, but did you hear the second part about the whole queen thing?"
Lord Dudley nodded solemnly.
"He succumbed to the affliction this morning."
Jane's gaze went vacant. She stared at nothing for a long moment.
She edged toward her and then back, not sure what to do. Was she going to faint, or would she consider that a very cliché thing for a woman to do? Desperate to console her, he almost considered shouting, "Quick, someone get her a book, any book!" But he wasn't sure if she was the stubborn Jane of the I Have Servants for that variety, or the Jane he'd almost kissed earlier, and he didn't want to be humiliated in court by having his attempts to help his wife rebuked, especially if she was to be queen. A flurry of activity broke out at one end of the throne room as Jane's mother swept in. "Darling Jane," she said, swooping over to her daughter, taking her in her arms, "I am so sorry about your dearest friend and cousin, the King." She spoke louder than necessary, but G suspected she wanted everyone to hear. Jane limply returned her mother's embrace, and then, all at once, seemed to notice that the throne room was bursting with people, and every single one of their faces was focused on her.
"I think I'd like to be excused for a moment," she said, a little louder, and to no one in particular. "I'm sure the rest of you need time to mourn as well."
She glanced at Lord Dudley, who seemed surprised by Jane's declaration.
"I'm sorry, my lady, but you need to stay for the coronation," the Duke said.
"Oh," Jane said, "is the new king to be crowned immediately?"
Lord Dudley frowned.
"No, a new queen."
"Ah," she said, "Princess Mary?"
"No, it is you, my lady."
Lord Dudley bowed in her direction. Jane turned to her left, then to her right, seeming to search for the lady to whom he was referring, and then recognition dawned upon her face. Her mouth opened slightly.
But I don't want to be queen. It's not my right. Mary is the rightful heir."
A squire stepped forward and unrolled a scroll of paper.
"By royal decree from His Majesty King Edward, a revised line of succession. Upon the event of my death, I bequeath my kingdom and the entitlements and protections thereof to the Lady Jane Grey and the male heirs who follow her."
Lord Dudley raised an elbow.
"May I escort you to the throne so we can commence with the coronation?"
"So quickly?"
She stepped back.
"We need a queen. Now, my lady," Lord Dudley said.
Jane's mother bowed deeply before her. G could tell from Jane's face that this act was perhaps the most disturbing gesture of support she could have received. Her brows knitted together, her hands stayed firmly at her side, and she gazed pleadingly at G. He was pretty sure if she could turn into a brown Carpathian bull, she would stampede out of the castle and never return.
"Horse,"
she mouthed. He then realized she wanted him to become a horse and carry her far away. She wished he had the ability to comply. Here was his lady, shaking ever so minutely under the heavy stares of every member of court. This was the Jane with the brilliant red hair and radiant face, the one who didn't pretend everything was under her control, the one who was most accustomed to a book staring back at her, not a person, not a room full of people, the one who, realizing what a formidable task ruling a country was, would never lunge for the crown when given the chance. This was his lady, his wife. And he would take care of her. G stepped forward, took her hand, and draped it over his arm. They stood nose to nose for a very long moment, the hum of murmurs in the throne room dimming to near silence.
"You can do this,"
G whispered. Her voice was ragged.
"I can't,"
he shrugged. "Okay,
We'll tell them, thank you so much for the very kind offer of running the country, but no thank you. I have no desire to honour my cousin the King's wishes. Now, where are my damn books? Jane cracked the tiniest of smiles.
That sounds about right.
Or perhaps, as an alternative, and merely a suggestion, she ran his fingers lightly over her knuckles, you could accept the throne and do everything you said you would do if you ever ran the country. She looked up. He took her face in his hands. Remember the people we helped? Now you could help an entire kingdom, from giving the highest born a new perspective and lending aid to the lowest peasants. We could help them together. I'll be right here with you, except when... I have to be outside, but I'm with you, Jane.
Is it possible,
Jane said,
that we could help others and rule?
G gave her a look of eternal optimism. Let's not forget the free fountain of never-ending ale. Jane threw her arms around G, taking him and the entire court by surprise. The more conservative ladies in the throne room daintily held lace handkerchiefs to their bright cheeks. The servants in attendance gave one another knowing looks, as though to say, with such a forward lady, no wonder there were shredded clothes in the wedding bedchamber. Lord Dudley, on the other hand, beamed as if the couple were producing a male heir right then and there. A chill went down G's spine at the sight of his father's smile. His father never smiled, which made G wonder just what the Duke was up to. Lord Dudley led Jane to the throne, but she would not let go of G's hand. In fact, she squeezed his fingers until he winced, increasing the pressure as the Archbishop of Canterbury lowered the crown onto her head. She let go only to hold the scepter and the orb, the final symbols of the monarchy. The hand with the orb shook, and Jane's eyes narrowed enough that G thought she might chuck the ball toward Lord Dudley's eagle nose. He had to admit it provided a very tempting target, but she refrained and placed the orb and scepter back on the pillow. "Long live Queen Jane!" Lord Dudley announced. "Long live the Queen!" the members of court replied. And it was over. Just like that. Hours ago, they were alone in their country house, possibly about to kiss. And now, Jane was queen. Although G had missed the last few years of court, and therefore any sort of changes to royal protocol, he distinctly remembered the coronation of King Edward. There'd been 3 days of celebrations in anticipation of the event, and the coronation itself had lasted hours. And it had taken place in the opulent Westminster Cathedral, not this less-than-formal throne room. King Edward had been 9 at the time, and seemed barely able to stand under the weight of the crown and the royal robes. But Jane's coronation had lasted 10 minutes. There were no street-side celebrations to welcome the new queen, none of the pomp and splendour that should accompany a coronation. Even now, as G glanced around the throne room, the expressions on faces ranged from forced smiles to worried glances, excepting the mother of the Queen and G's own still strangely beaming father. Lord Dudley stood by the throne, assuming a position of power a little prematurely by G's assessment. A line had formed to receive the Queen and vow allegiance to her, but G was no longer watching the line. Instead, movement at the entrance caught his attention. A messenger entered the room, cautiously, as all messengers did after the reign of the Lion King. When Lord Dudley saw the messenger, he casually stepped away from the throne and met the boy, who handed over a sealed envelope. G tilted his head to get a better view around a particularly portly lady-in-waiting.
Lord Dudley broke the seal, but not before G noticed a royal imprint in the red wax that sealed the letter. As the Duke read the parchment, he frowned, and then frowned deeper. He refolded the letter, stowed it in his pocket, and hastened away. No one else took note of the transaction. The once uncertain atmosphere around Jane had turned into excitement for the new Queen of England. G leaned down to whisper in Jane's ear.
"Your Majesty."
Her eyes flashed.
"Don't you dare, Your Majesty, me."
He smiled.
"My lady, please excuse me for a moment."
Worry sparked in Jane's eyes, but she nodded.
"Hurry back."
G quickly and quietly followed his father to a far corner of the room. Lord Dudley pulled his most trusted adviser inside a small alcove. He produced the envelope and handed it over. The adviser read the contents, frowned, and dropped the hand holding the letter to his side.
"It is as I feared,"
Lord Dudley said. "Despite our best efforts, word of Jane's ascension has reached Mary before our men could apprehend her. Someone must have sent warning." G ducked a little farther behind a pillar.
"Where is she?"
his adviser asked.
"They do not know. She has most probably fled to Kenninghall. But more importantly, she refuses to accept Jane as rightful queen."
G felt his heart beating through his ribs at this news, but what his father said next was even more frightening.
"Find her. Arrest her. Do it before nightfall tomorrow. If we fail, Mary could retain the backing of the army, and then we will lose the throne."
G's skin went cold as the adviser rushed toward the exit, presumably to execute Lord Dudley's orders. How had Mary not known about the revised order of succession? Maybe the king had not gone so far as to consult with his sisters, but surely he'd at least told them about his wishes before his death. Hadn't he? G watched as his father pulled down on the ends of his jacket and straightened his back, all the while shifting his face from a tense expression to one of practiced, optimistic decorum. G strode over to him.
"Father,"
he said.
Lord Dudley startled, but recovered quickly. "Gifford, you should be attending to the Queen." "Father, I saw the messenger."
The Duke made a swatting motion with his hand.
"Oh, that was nothing. A trifle about your new living quarters. So many things to arrange."
G took a deep breath, hesitant to reveal his eavesdropping, but he had to know more.
"I heard what you said to your adviser about Mary."
Lord Dudley took hold of G's arm and yanked him behind one of the ornate royal banners hanging from the ceiling.
"Be careful, son. Do not speak of such things. They are not your concern."
"If they are a threat to my wife, they are very much my concern,"
G said, trying hard to keep from raising his voice.
"I beg to differ. A queen and her consort do not need to be informed of every little detail of running a kingdom. That's why I have a job."
"Little detail? I heard you say—"
G spoke too loudly, and his father cut him off with a scathing glance.
"I heard you say,"
G continued quietly,
that we could lose the throne if Mary is not captured."
The Duke placed a heavy hand on G's shoulder and threw his nose to the air as he inhaled sharply. G was surprised he didn't inhale half the court along the way.
"Son, I am only going to explain this once. Your wife is queen. The late King Edward provided for this succession and received the ratifying signatures from all 31 members of the Privy Council. You are the Queen's consort, and very soon you will make a powerful king."
Gee, as king? Well, that was a terrifying idea, but he and Jane had talked at length about what they'd do if they ruled the country. Together they could make a difference. Besides, he'd look great in a crown.
Still, you have much to learn, his father went on. Leave these matters to me. Trust me, I will not allow a foot-stomping, illegitimate hag to get in my way.
You mean to get in the Queen's way? G said slowly. Right, father? The Queen's way?
Yes, yes, the Queen's way,
Lord Dudley said dismissively. But Mary is rather popular among the people, despite being a bit duddy. If she rallies support, G's father put a hand up. Gifford, I have put forth great effort to secure your future and the future of our country. I have done things you would never be brave enough to do. Focus on becoming king. Until then, keep your expert opinions limited to things you understand, like apples.
With that, his father ducked out from behind the banner, leaving G with that fallen expression that can only come from the harsh rebuke of a father. He stepped out from the chapel. When Jane saw him, she didn't smile. Maybe his father was right. Until he was crowned king, he shouldn't worry about things that didn't concern him.
13. Edward. The king, the actual king, we mean, through no particular fault of his own, was lost. During the first few hours in his newly acquired Ethian form, he'd been caught up in what he could only describe as a kind of beautiful bird joy, the sweet euphoria of flight, of riding the wind, testing the strength of his wings, encompassed in the soundless serenity of the world as seen from so high above. He'd lost himself in how good it felt to no longer be... well, dying. Edward didn't know this at the time, because he had no way of looking at himself and assessing what kind of species of bird he actually was, but he had transformed into a kestrel, which is, for those readers who are not bird enthusiasts, a small falcon, Falco tinnunculus, with very handsome brown speckled feathers. Edward simply knew that he had wings and a beak and two legs that ended in talons, which made him some kind of bird. And he knew that up there, against the sky, he was free in a way that he had never been free before. But after a while, who knows how long really, as kestrels aren't known for their ability to keep track of time, he began to have a nagging human thought in the back of his brain, and it... was this. I should be doing something. Which led to, I should be going somewhere. He strained to remember more. It's not somewhere that I should be going to so much as someone, he thought. Someone who will help me. Then he remembered that he was not just a bird, but a king, and someone had attempted to assassinate him and steal his throne, and he had a sister named Bess who had told him... what had she told him? That his mother had also been a bird, a beautiful white bird, and wasn't it divine to be a bird, to rule the air, to dive and lift so, to hover, and then the bird joy had him again. Sometime later he thought, no, that wasn't all Bess told me. She said to go to Gran. His grandmother, although he hadn't seen the old lady in years. At Helmsley, which was an abandoned, half-fallen-down old castle. North, somewhere. Now, which way was north? As a 16-year-old human boy, Edward had never possessed the keenest sense of direction, since most of the time when he wished to travel to a place he was taken by carriage and did none of the driving.
As an only a few hours old bird, he didn't know north either. He knew there was a river in one direction and a series of low hills in another direction, an expansive green field below him, and in that field he somehow knew there was a little brown field mouse just coming out of its hole. Without consulting him at all, his body plummeted toward the defenseless creature, wings tucking in, talons reaching, until Edward the bird struck the mouse with tremendous force and snatched it from the face of the earth. The poor thing gave a rather awful shriek, which was understandable, and then went quiet. Edward the bird flapped off to a nearby tree branch, still clutching the mouse, and then, to Edward the boy's horror, he ate it, bones and fur and all. Edward stayed in the tree for a while, disgusted with himself on the one hand, and on the other wanting to go out and find another delicious mouse, or perhaps a tasty garter snake. A growing bird has to eat. But he needed to get control of these bird impulses, he decided. He needed to get moving. The sun was going down. Hadn't it just been morning? "North. I need to find my way north," he told himself sternly. "Which way was north again?" "The sun goes down in the west," he recalled vaguely. He subsequently pointed himself toward what would be, by extension, north. But once he was in the air, it was only a few minutes before the wind charmed him again and the bird joy overtook him, and when he came back to himself, more hours had passed, and it was dark, and there was no way to know which direction he'd been flying in and which way he should go. So, as we said before, the king was lost. For a while, he followed a carriage that was making its way slowly down a road. The carriage must be carrying someone important, he concluded, because there were mounted guards riding on all sides of it. Then he figured that someone with so many men, perhaps 20, could be heading toward London, and that was the last place he wanted to go, so he turned around and flew in the opposite direction. The road led him to a shabby-looking village. At the edge of the small cluster of buildings there was a large oak tree, and he settled into the upper branches and looked around. His eyesight, he found, was quite marvellous in the dark. The village was comprised of a scattering of cottages with thatched roofs and a smoke-bellowing building that must be the blacksmith, a small stable, and a large ramshackle wooden building in the centre that seemed to loom over all the others, with lit windows and a sign over its door with a horse head carved into it. He could hear bawdy music from inside, and men laughing and talking loudly. An inn. He could become human again and go inside. People would surely recognize him. After all, his face was on their coins. His subjects loved him, didn't they? He was their beloved king, deigned by God to be their ruler. That was what he'd always been told. But how did one return from bird to human, exactly? There were no magic words that he was aware of, no series of gestures, no spells to transform him. He wasn't entirely sure how he'd managed to go from human to bird before. He'd simply jumped from the window and wished for wings and hoped he wouldn't die. He glanced at the inn again. In an inn there'd be food, real food, not mice, and dinner rolls, and tall glasses of ale, all of which would almost certainly not be poisoned. There'd be stew, maybe rabbit stew, so tender it almost melted in your mouth, with onion and a bit of carrot and potato, something that would warm his empty belly at last. There might even be blackberries. Edward fell out of the tree. Since he was in the highest branches, his crash down made a spectacular amount of noise, branches breaking and Edward cursing and then thumping hard onto the ground. He landed on his left ankle all wrong, which alerted him to the fact that he had ankles again. He had done it somehow. He had wished to be a human eating human food, and here he was. The door to the nearest cottage was flung open, and a large red-faced woman wearing an apron stepped out.
She was holding a rolling pin. From behind her wafted the smell of baking bread, which instantly made Edward's stomach grumble and his mouth began to water. Lord, he was hungry. He struggled to his feet. His ankle hurt so much his eyes watered.
"Madam,"
he wheezed. The woman looked him up and down, which is when Edward realized a second important bit of news about himself. He was, apparently, naked. Edward tried to respond to this humiliating situation in as kingly a way as possible. Kings didn't cower down, holding their hands in front of their private parts, like simpletons. He stood up straight, tried to look her in the eye.
Madam, I know this looks less than ideal, but I can explain. I'm pervert, she screamed.
No, no, you've got it all wrong. You're one of those filthy Essenes, aren't you? She yelled, her face growing even redder in hue. Or maybe she didn't have it all wrong.
This was a decent village, you know, before your kind came around spoiling it. Thieves and murderers, the lot of you, like those dogs that watch me get dressed through the window and then run away. Perverts! No, I can assure you I never...
The woman's mouth opened and she brandished the rolling pin over her head like a Highland warrior.
Pervert!
She screamed, and then she ran at him, clubbing him wherever she could reach. Edward tried to run. His ankle didn't cooperate, and he was out of breath within a few steps, so he didn't get away as quickly as he would have liked. But the woman wasn't in the best of shape herself. After she'd beat him about the head with her rolling pin a few times, she seemed satisfied to fall back screaming, "Pervert!" after him as Edward stumbled on nakedly through the night. He tried to steal some clothes that were hanging to dry outside of a farmer's house farther down the road, but the farmer had a dog who wound up giving him a nasty bite on his right leg, the uninjured one, of course. Finally, he ended up at another farm in the hayloft of a large barn, hiding under a horse blanket in a pile of prickly hay.
"I'm better off as a bird," he thought miserably.
He tried to turn himself back, to imagine himself with wings again, but nothing happened. The hay made him sneeze, and then cough some more. The poison was still inside of him, working its evil. He was so weak, and now his ankle throbbed, his calf burned from where the dog had bit him. There was a goose egg rising near his temple where the woman had beamed him with the blasted rolling pin, and bruises forming up and down his thin, shivering arms, which bore scabbing cuts from Master Boo Boo's bloodletting. Plus he was cold, and hungry, and horribly, horribly lost. He buried his face in the blanket and blinked back bitter tears. What he wouldn't give for his dog right now, her warmth and her protection, even though the thought of Pet as a girl continued to unsettle him. Now Pet was lost to him too. Everything was lost. Jane, Bess, his crown, the kingdom. What was he going to do? Then, because he was exhausted on top of being poisoned and injured and starving, the king, or we suppose that Edward was technically no longer the king at this point because the carriage he'd seen earlier had contained Jane and Gifford on their way to the castle, and Jane had only moments before been crowned the official Queen of England, the boy who had been king then dropped off into a fitful sleep. He woke up with a lantern burning bright next to his head and a knife at his throat, because this was the kind of night he was having.
"Hello,"
said the owner of the knife. A girl. A girl about his age, no older than 18, surely, although it was hard to tell in this light. A girl with startling green eyes. He didn't dare to move, because... knife...
"Well,"
she said after a long moment,
"what do you have to say for yourself, then?"
Only Edward didn't understand what she said, because what he heard was, "Well, what do ye have to see for yourself, then?"
"You're Scottish,"
he murmured.
"Am I in Scotland?"
she snorted.
"I'll take that as a no," he said. The green eyes narrowed. The knife didn't leave his throat.
"Who are you?"
she demanded, and he caught her meaning this time. "What are you doing here?" He didn't know how to answer her questions. If he told her who he really was, chances were that, A, she wouldn't believe him and she'd cut his throat, or B, she'd believe him, and because he was the ruler of England and she was Scottish and this was the year 1553, she'd get even more pleasure out of cutting his throat. Neither option ended well for him. She was looking at him expectantly, and the knife against his neck was cold and decidedly unpleasant, so he decided he'd better start talking and he'd better make it good.
"My name's Dennis," he burst out.
"Dennis?"
she repeated, still with the knife.
"Is that your first name or your last name?"
"I'm an apprentice for the blacksmith in the village,"
he said quickly, to cover that he didn't actually know whether Dennis was his first or last name,
"and I was set upon by thieves on the road."
At this, the girl's mouth turned up in a charming, or Edward would have found it charming if she hadn't been threatening his life at the moment, little smile. She was pretty, and the green eyes were the least of it. A riot of headstrong black curls cascaded all around her face, which was pale and heart-shaped, with a delicate pointed chin and a small red mouth.
"You're a poor liar, is what you are."
With the hand not holding the knife, she suddenly pulled back the horse blanket that was covering him and gave him a quick once-over, neck to toes and everything in between. Edward was too shocked to protest.
"Just checking to make sure you didn't have a sword under there," she said with a smirk. "But I don't see anything particularly dangerous."
She removed the knife from his neck and sat back.
"Poor wee thing. You're a bit of a mess, aren't you?"
Edward grabbed the blanket back from her and pulled it to his chest. He wasn't sure what she could be referring to as a poor wee thing. Certainly no part of him. His face was hot as a branding iron.
"I was set upon by thieves, as I told you," he stammered finally. "They took everything."
"Oh, wearing fine silks, were you? Poppycock. Who are you, really?"
She grabbed his hand and turned it over in hers.
"Because you don't have the hands of a blacksmith, that's sure."
He jerked his hand away and rose unsteadily to his feet, still clutching the unwieldy blanket around him. The girl stood up too and brushed hay off her trousers. She was wearing trousers, he realized. Black trousers and a white tunic and a black cloak with black boots that came nearly to her knees. He'd never seen a woman in trousers before. It was improper and unnerving and surprisingly attractive.
"Who are you?" he fired back. "Because I don't think you're the farmer's daughter."
The green eyes flashed, but she smiled again.
"Do you know what I think?"
He couldn't begin to guess.
"I think you're an Ethian on the run,"
she said, "and when it started raining you ran in here for shelter, in your animal form, of course, so now you're stuck here without a stitch of clothes." She tisked her tongue sympathetically.
"So what animal form do you take?"
"It's raining now," he said, and then he became aware of the pounding of water against the roof, because again, this was the kind of night he was having.
"Are you part of the pack?" she asked. "You seem a bit green for that."
He was about to say something like he didn't know what she was talking about with the pack, and of course he wasn't an Ethian, but before he could get this out, the girl's head cocked slightly to one side, listening, and then she snuffed the lantern. The hayloft was plunged into inky blackness. "What?" he started, but she stepped close and put a finger to his lips to quiet him, and he lost his train of thought. Below them, the barn door opened. A man bearing a lantern shuffled in. He spent a few minutes feeding the animals, all the while grumbling about the rain. The entire time Edward and the girl stood frozen in the hayloft, a breath away from each other, her fingers still against his lips. Even in the dark, her eyes were green, like the emeralds in the crown jewels. He was holding his breath. He wanted to kiss her, he realized, which was ludicrous. She'd been holding a knife at his throat moments ago. She was a stranger. She was a woman who wore pants. She couldn't be trusted. Still, there she was, her finger against his lips, making him think of putting his lips on her lips. And when his gaze dropped from her eyes to her lips, a girlish flush spread over her cheeks, which made him want to kiss her even more. The farmer went out. The girl stepped back, the humour gone out of her expression. She cleared her throat and fingered the knife in her belt nervously.
"I should go," she said.
For some reason, this was the last thing he expected. For her to leave now, after she'd woken him and threatened him and questioned him so relentlessly. Now she was leaving, and he didn't want her to go. "But it's raining." This sounded lame even to him. "And you haven't found out who I am yet?" She shrugged.
"Sadly, I don't care that much."
She moved toward the ladder that would take her down to the barn floor. In another minute, she'd be gone, and he'd be here in the same situation he'd started in. No clothes, no money, no plan. Alone. "Wait," he called. She started down the ladder. She'd just reached the bottom when the barn door swung open, and there was the farmer again, this time holding a rusted old sword. The girl moved like she would run, but the farmer thrust the business end of the blade right at her chest. She froze.
"I knew you was in here," the farmer growled. "Couldn't stay away from my chickens, could you? Had to come back for the rest."
She lifted her hands in a kind of surrender, but that aggravating smile tugged at her mouth.
"They were very tasty chickens. I couldn't help myself."
The farmer snorted in disgust.
"I ought to run you through right here and be done with you, but I'll turn you over to the magistrate in the morning, and he'll cut off one of your hands. That'll teach you."
"I should do something," Edward thought, "save her somehow." But he was naked and unarmed, not exactly a knight in shining armour. The girl stood up straighter.
"Or what about this? You let me go, and I'll steer clear of your chickens in the future."
Without waiting for an answer to her proposal, she fainted to one side and then darted to the other, but the man caught her by the hair. He dragged her away from the door. She struggled, reaching for her knife, but he grabbed it first and tossed it onto the dirt floor.
"I really should do something," Edward thought. "Now would be good."
"Or maybe," the farmer said, "I'll cut off your hand myself."
"Okay, that does it," Edward thought. There was a flash of light in the hayloft. The farmer looked up, startled, and then the bird that was Edward descended on him, talons clawing at the man's face. The farmer screamed and released his sword. The girl took this opportunity to knee the farmer in the acorns. He dropped to the floor. She kicked him. She paused then, as if she might say something, one of her smart little lines, but she seemed to think better of it. She just grabbed up her knife and ran. Edward followed her as best as he could from above. It was a good thing that as a bird he had sharp eyes, because she had a skill for melting into the shadows of the forest. It was difficult for him to navigate the trees. The rain was letting up, at least, a drizzle now, and the moon peeked between the clouds. The girl ran on and on, light on her feet, pacing herself, as if she were accustomed to taking such outings in the middle of the night. She went for more than a mile or two before she stopped in a small grove to rest. Edward fluttered to the branches in the tree above her. She glanced up.
"Should I be worried about bird droppings on my head?"
She laughed at him. He gave an indignant squawk.
"Come down. You can change back now."
She swung her cloak from off her shoulders.
"Here."
He dropped to the ground, but then he stood there for several minutes in bird form without anything flashy happening.
"You really are a greenie, aren't you?" she asked. "Do you not even know how to change back, then?" He changed, still naked. The girl looked at the ground with a stifled smile and held out the cloak. Edward grabbed it and put it on, which was loads better than the horse blanket, but still left him feeling exposed and draughty. "Thanks for your help." The girl tucked a stray black curl behind her ear. "I'd have gotten clear of him myself, but it would have been messier." "So you're a chicken thief," Edward said. "Among other things," she admitted. He'd never met a common criminal before. He would have found the whole thing wildly exciting if he wasn't so tired of things being so wildly exciting. "I'm Greasy," she said, meeting his eyes. "Is that your first name or your last name?" he said. She grinned. "Grace McTavish," she clarified, and gave a little bow. "At your service." "Edward," he replied simply. "Not Dennis?" She had dimples, he noticed, not when she smiled so much as when she was trying not to smile. "Not Dennis."
"Good. I would have felt sorry for you with a name like Dennis. Shall we go?"
"Where?" he asked.
"Somewhere safer."
Safer sounded good. Out of habit, he held out his arm. She looked at him incredulously, but then she took it, and they started walking.
"I would have turned back there," she said as they made their way through the trees, "but then I would have lost my clothes as well, and it's a half-day's hard run to the next place I've got clothes stashed, and I adore these boots," she added.
"Turned? So you're an Ethian?" His heart thudded stupidly in his chest. What was it about this girl that flustered him so?
"Yes, an Ethian," she said. "I've never seen a kestrel Ethian before. You make an attractive bird."
His stomach turned over.
"I'm a kestrel? Are you quite sure that's what I am?" "I'm not much for bird watching, but I know my birds of prey," she said. "Why should that bother you?"
He didn't answer, but the truth was that in the rules of falconry, which Edward had been practicing since he was a boy, there were certain birds suited to certain stations. The king's bird was the gerfalcon, the largest and most majestic bird of them all. As a prince, he had worked with falcons, only slightly lesser in grandeur, while his father's knights had used sacrés, the ladies' merlins, the squires' lanners, and so on and so on. The kestrel was the smallest and weakest of the falcon species. Only the servants worked with kestrels. He stifled a cough.
"What animal are you?"
"Dimples."
"I suppose you'll have to wait and see."
His legs suddenly felt weak, and it wasn't from the effect of the pretty girl. All of this exertion had been too much for him. His head was cloudy. He stumbled. She tightened her grip on his arm.
"You're not well," she observed. "Do you want to stop?"
He nodded. She led him under a tree with a large root sticking out of it where he could sit. He spent several minutes coughing weakly into the cloak. She stood a few paces away, studying him.
"Do you have the affliction?"
She looked a bit worried at the prospect of having strolled arm in arm with a diseased man.
"No."
Edward looked up at her.
"No, I was being poisoned."
Those mischievous eyebrows of hers lifted.
"Poisoned? By whom?"
"By Lord Dudley," he said, too tired now to try to think up an answer besides the truth.
"Why would someone want to poison you?"
"Because—" This was it. The moment he'd tell her who he was, and she'd have to decide what to do with him.
"Because I'm—"
He tried again.
"Out with that," she urged. "I'm not sure I can stand the suspense."
Well, if she was going to decide to cut his throat after all, at least it'd be over quickly. Best to be done with it.
"I'm Edward Tudor," he answered, "and I need your help."
14.
Jane.
Well, she was queen.
That was unexpected.
Jane gave a half-panicked, disbelieving laugh. How could Edward do this to her? Why would he do this to her? He didn't even believe that women belonged in leadership positions. If Edward had been in his right mind, he never would have chosen to make her queen. That must have been it. Edward hadn't been in his right mind. He'd had the affliction boiling his brain and ruining his decision-making skills, which had, until recently, in her opinion, been quite reasonable.
But what could Edward possibly expect her to do with his crown? She laughed again, although it came out as more of a sob. She was the queen, the ruler, the monarch, the sovereign, the leader, the head of state, the chief, the one wearing the proverbial pants, the person in charge, the boss, the Queen of England.
Jane had always resisted the notion that women were weaker than men, not just physically, but intellectually. Her education had been as good as Edward's, they had even shared some of the same tutors for a time, and Jane had always excelled at whatever she put her mind to. She could speak 8 languages, for heaven's sake, and was considered by some of her instructors to be a marvel at rhetoric and reasoning. She understood the complexities of philosophy and the nuances of religion. She devoured books several times a day, the way ordinary people took their meals. She memorized poetry in Latin simply to pass the time. All this she could do as well as any man.
But could she rule a country?
Jane paced her new bedroom, a chamber in the royal apartments of the Tower of London, fit for, what else, a queen.
Last night, after receiving her subjects, the thought made Jane's stomach lurch, she'd been sent to her chambers to rest, Lord Dudley citing that a queen should not be kept up so late, and she'd need to be refreshed for a long day of queenly activities that awaited her in the morning. Jane had been exhausted, so she'd complied, but she'd made certain everyone knew she wasn't being sent to her room like a child. She'd shot Gifford a quick look. Was he coming? But Lord Dudley pulled Gifford aside to speak with him. So Jane had grabbed a book without checking what it was. It turned out to be Afterlives, the 100-year debate of Ethians and reincarnation, and hurled it onto the gigantic bed when she realized it was about death.
Then it had truly hit her. Edward was dead. She would never see him again. He was gone.
After a long, angry cry, she hadn't been able to sleep, so as the sun lifted and somewhere, hopefully outside, Gifford turned into a horse, she explored her chambers. The decor was annoyingly opulent. Long silk brocade drapes framed the windows, while several wardrobes lined the walls, filled with more gowns than she could imagine wearing. In the 2 places along the wall not occupied by wardrobes, there was a door that presumably joined the Queen's rooms with the King's, and a vanity with a large glass mirror, just in case she wanted to look at herself and admire how very queenly she wasn't. No, there were circles under her eyes from last night's journey and devastation. Her skin, previously flushed from days in the sun, now looked sallow and drawn. Her eyes were raw from crying, itchy and red and as puffy as a pastry, not to mention all her normal flaws. She looked nothing at all like a queen. The worst part about her new chambers was that all these wardrobes and vanities and drapes meant there was no space, none at all, for a bookcase. Who on earth could feel comfortable enough to sleep in a room with no books?
Edward would never sleep again, she reminded herself tearfully. He would never read a book again.
A knock sounded, and she ignored it, choosing instead to flop down in the center of her bed, surrounded by pillows and blankets, and compose a mental list of all the things Edward would never do again. Obvious things like eating and breathing she skipped.
She was on number 27, scratching his dog behind the ears, and number 28, eating ridiculous amounts of blackberry pudding, when her visitor knocked again, then entered anyway. "Good morning!" Her mother swept into the room, followed by a troop of ladies-in-waiting. At Lady Frances's instructions, some of the ladies drew a bath, scenting the water with rose oil until the smell filled the room and Jane's eyes watered. Others opened the vanity, selecting a frightening array of cosmetics. Still more put tray after tray of food on a table, sausages and eggs, bread drizzled with honey, and fruit with rivers of cream. As all this activity unfolded around her, Jane remained on the bed, unmoving and unmoved. "Well?" Lady Frances snapped her fingers at Jane, drawing startled glances from the maids. After a moment, she seemed to realize what she'd done, and softened her voice as she dropped her hand to her side. "Jane, my dear, Your Majesty, it's time for a bath and breakfast. You must prepare to meet your people." Jane had met her people last night.
"I'm mourning my cousin."
"I know, my dear, but you must... That is, I think it would be wise to show yourself strong and capable immediately. Don't wait for a crisis before you take action."
"You think I should take action?"
Jane asked. "Indeed." Her mother's mouth twitched into a smile. "I think you should immediately prove yourself a capable ruler."
"Capable. Right."
Jane fidgeted with the corner of a woven blanket. Another thing Edward would never do.
"There are some issues I feel should be addressed. Minor issues."
"Huge issues." When Gifford had taken her face between his hands and reminded her about their conversations in the country house, he'd made her remember the people. That was the only reason she'd agreed to take the throne. The people. The poor. She would do anything to help them.
"Good."
Lady Frances offered a hand and tugged Jane from the fortress of blankets. "Then we'll bring those items before the Privy Council and begin solidifying your reign. You know Lord Dudley desires to aid you in the same manner he aided King Edward, may he rest in peace, as well as many others in the court, including myself. We all want to help you become the queen you were meant to be."
"I was never meant to be queen."
"And yet you are."
"Do you think I'll make a good one?"
Jane's voice was unintentionally small. The words weren't what she'd aimed for either, but as soon as they were out, she was overcome with the desire for her mother's approval and support. Lady Frances narrowed her eyes and gazed at Jane the same way she scrutinized the servants at their housework.
"If you can focus on ruling the kingdom instead of reading those silly books, you'll be a queen always remembered."
Apparently even Jane's ascension to the throne wasn't enough to make her mother proud of her. She swallowed down her disappointment. It didn't matter, she told herself. She didn't need her mother any more. She had Gifford. Jane didn't know if she could rule a country. She wasn't meant for a life on the throne. She wasn't even remotely prepared to be queen. But she did know one thing. Gifford would be there with her. He would help her, and she was going to give it her very best try.
"I want to see Edward's body," Jane announced later, "to say goodbye."
She was walking through the hall with her mother, Lord Dudley, trailing a few steps behind. They were on their way to the first of the day's activities, not that anyone had bothered to tell her what it was. She supposed she'd find out soon enough, and in the meantime the silence between the three of them was ripe for making demands.
"I want to see his body today, this morning."
"I'm afraid that's simply not a good idea, Your Majesty."
Dudley's tone was gruff. "He was quite ill. It's best to remember him as he was before." Jane choked back a wave of hot grief.
"I want to see him. Where is he?
"'It's simply not appropriate, Your Majesty,' Jane clenched her jaw, then deliberately unclenched it. "'I am the Queen, and I demand to see my cousin's body.'
"'There's simply too much to do today.'
"'If Lord Dudley said simply once more, she'd simply have his head chopped off.'